Our next speaker is it's a special guest tonight that we were only able to make contact with her in the latter days, so she doesn't appear on the program, but it's Dr. Rosalie Bertell. And Dr. Bertell is one of the world's leading authorities on the health effects of low-level radiation. For a decade, she worked for the U.S. National Cancer Institute, and for 30 years has been in the forefront of research on the impact of low-level radiation on human health. And she will be here to tell us about a little publicized aspect of this war. Dr. Bertell.
I'd like to talk about a little-known factor in this war, and that is the kind of ammunition which is being used. It's called depleted uranium, but don't let that fool you. It doesn't mean it's harmless. Depleted uranium is basically radioactive waste. It's the waste from uranium enrichment. When the uranium is taken out of the ground, most of it is uranium-238, but they like the fissioning of 235, which is less than 1% of the whole. So when they do uranium enrichment, they basically try to increase the proportion of the uranium-235 that fissions, and the rest of the uranium, and a lot of it, is considered waste. For a long time, in the 70s, there was an effort to declare this waste scrap metal and use it in our refrigerators and stoves and bicycles and automobiles. And many of us were out there protesting this. And we actually won. And they stopped talking about that, but very quietly on the side, they gave this uranium free of charge to the weapons manufacturers. And what they discovered was it's more dense than lead, which means it goes through a tank or an armored car or a bulletproof vest. It's what's called autopyrophoric, which means it can burst into flame. It's and when it does, it becomes an aerosol. And also, you know how when you make pottery, if you put it in a kiln and fire it, you get a glass? Well, that's what happens to uranium when you ignite it in battle. And so this was actually used for the first time by the Russians in Afghanistan, but on a very small scale. The first time it was used on a very large scale was in Iraq in the Gulf War. And it was used extensively by the U.S. and the U.K. According to the Pentagon, 400,000 American veterans were exposed to this depleted uranium aerosol in the Gulf War. About 200,000 of these men and women have sought medical care since the war, and about 115,000 have been diagnosed as having Gulf War syndrome. Now, one would think in the United States of America, given this new weapon and this massive exposure and these sick veterans, that they would have tested the veterans for depleted uranium. I was in Washington, D.C. 10 days ago, and I found that not one American veteran has been tested for depleted uranium in the 9 years since the Iraq War. We actually have tested some of the veterans here in Canada, and we have found depleted uranium in their urine. at quite a high level. And remember, this is 9 years after their exposure, which means that the amount that they now are excreting is nothing compared to what the original dose was. There has been quite a dispute, which some of you may know, since the war is on in Kosovo, whether or not depleted uranium ammunition was being used. In a sense, this adds to the problem, but you should know that every cruise missile contains depleted uranium ballast, and when that missile impacts, that ballast is again aerosolized into very small particles of uranium glass that can be breathed in, and it will stay in the body 10 years and more. It keeps irradiating the tissue around wherever it is in the body. Canada has been an international leader against landmines. But this depleted uranium is worse than landmines. And it will stay around for thousands of years after the war is over. It's incorporated into the farmland. It can be picked up by the vegetables. The shrapnel can be handled by children. It stays around. It doesn't disappear. Because it's an aerosol, it can travel as much as 50, 60 kilometers from the point of release. This is chemical and radiological warfare. It's outrageous. It's a very serious violation of human rights. I think this talk about chemical warfare in Iraq and violation of human rights in Serbia is outrageous, because if anyone is waging chemical and radiological warfare and violating human rights, it's NATO. In 1996, this issue was brought before the Human Rights Tribunal in Geneva, and the tribunal condemned it as warfare. They called depleted uranium a weapon of mass destruction. I think it might be better called a weapon of indiscriminate destruction, but they didn't really have a term for it. I say indiscriminate because it will by choice affect women and children. Women have tissues that are more radiosensitive, like the breast and uterine tissue. Children are closer to the ground. They're growing. They'll incorporate more uranium into their bones as they grow, and they also have a longer lifespan. So that the cancers, which have a longer latency period, can be expressed. So it selects out women and children. Anyway, it was condemned by the United Nations Human Rights Commission, and they have appointed a rapporteur to prepare a brief for the United Nations. It's not completed yet. The World Health Organization has sent a team into Iraq to look at the aftermath of the war, but they just went in last fall, and they expect to spend 2 years in the study. So I think you can see that the forces for good here are slow compared to the extent at which this is being used and the rapidity with which it is being used, not only in Iraq, but Bosnia and Kosovo. So I would call this to your attention, and I would ask you to make this known. It's largely Canadian uranium that's being used. Canada has a policy that its uranium cannot be used in nuclear bombs. That policy does not extend to these DU weapons. So you really have to complain loudly about this. Canada also sends its uranium down to Paducah, Kentucky, to be enriched, and it does not ask for the return of the waste. If that waste stays in the United States for 30 days, by U.S. law, it becomes U.S. uranium. So Canadian uranium is basically providing the material for these weapons. And I really would ask you to make this an issue in the front center and stop it now as quickly as you can. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bertel. Our next speaker is a lawyer. David Jacobs is a lawyer with the Toronto law firm of Shell Jacobs. His special interest is international law. And David Jacobs' law firm will be hosting a press conference tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. where a group of lawyers has filed charges against the NATO leaders before the War Crimes Tribunal. Michael Mandel of Osgoode Hall Law School will be joining us later this evening to say a word from the floor about this case. He's the one who did most of the work in pulling it together. But the group charged includes Bill Clinton, Madeleine Albright, Janvier Solana, Jamie Shea, Jean Chrétien, Art Eggleton, Lloyd Axworth, Lloyd Axworthy, and 60 other heads of state and government, foreign ministers, defense ministers, and NATO officials with war crimes committed in NATO's six-week-old bombing campaign against Yugoslavia. David Jacobs.
Thank you very much. I want to put a very simple proposition to you, and I want to try and put it to you very clearly, and that is that this NATO war is illegal. And I want to say to you that it is illegal in a very, very fundamental way. Its illegality strikes at the heart of international law and of the system of international justice, which we have developed mostly under the auspices of the United Nations since the end of World War II. I should preface this by saying I have some personal reason for wanting to do this. I kind of want to vindicate myself after some people in the press have accused me of being involved with legal technicalities. I think that this war and the illegality of the war is a mere legal technicality, something like speeding violation when you're going 1 mile over the limit. I think it is not a legal technicality. I think it is fundamental. I think it presages very ill for the future of humanity. The system of international law, which grew up after World War II, grew up, as I say, under the auspices of the United Nations. The framers of the UN Charter, the Allied Nations, at the end of World War II, got together and put together the Charter as an international treaty precisely to end the scourge of war. I am afraid, I am frightened, that the scourge of the NATO war will end the United Nations, rather than the other way around. Two arguments have been advanced against me so as to try to provide some legal cloak for this war. One is, as I've said, that the illegalities are merely technical. We needn't worry about them. Secondly, that NATO is developing, out of thin air as it is, a new law of humanitarian intervention. Neither of these ideas holds up to the light. Neither of them holds up to any scrutiny. I want to, just again because I want to vindicate myself, I suppose, and I want to talk back to people who accuse me of being into legal technicalities, read to you, if you don't mind, if I can hold your attention. What I want to read to you from is the United Nations Charter. And I want you to remember while I do this, again, if you don't mind, that the United Nations Charter is a treaty, a solemn obligation entered into by Canada and all the NATO nations. It's an obligation by Canada to its own citizens and by Canada to all the other nations who are signatories to the treaty, the Charter, and the nations of the world. It provides as follows: all members of the United Nations shall settle their international disputes by peaceful means in such a matter that international peace and security and justice are not endangered. All members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the UN. The parties to any dispute, the continuance of which is likely to endanger the maintenance of international peace and security, shall first of all seek a solution by negotiation, inquiry, mediation, conciliation, arbitration, judicial settlement, resort to regional agencies or arrangements, or other peaceful means of their own choice. Now, Chapter 7 of the UN Charter and customary international law will say there are some exceptions. If your nation is attacked, you can fight back in self-defense. And the other important exception, which has already been adverted to here tonight, is the exception that if the United Nations Security Council unanimously authorizes it, war can be entered into as a final resort. Chapter 7 goes into some detail, though, as to how we do that. Firstly, the Security Council has to look at other means, short of war, for resolving the dispute. It has to inquire. It has to get a report back. It has to make a decision. Once it has made that evaluation, that nothing else can be done save for the use of force, the United Nations Security Council, by unanimous vote, can determine what forceful measures, including war, including blockades and so on, can be undertaken. And there's a whole mechanism set up under the UN Charter, including a military command consisting of nations which belong to the Security Council, which is set up under the authority of the Security Council. Now, this is not a technicality. This is vitally important, as the ambassador already talked to you, already said to you. It's vitally important. Why? World War II started when a group of nations, the Axis powers, determined by themselves, or at least so they told us, that very bad things were happening in countries which they wished to invade. Very bad things. Humanitarian disasters. Germans in the Sudetenland were being made refugees. Women were being raped. They were being killed. These sort of things were shown in newsreels in Germany. Something had to be done to restore order and to reduce ethnic tensions. The problem is, when any one nation says this to the world, big, rich, and powerful nations with the ability to enter into war, who evaluates it? NATO is now telling us that the Milosevic government is very bad. And they're telling us not only is the Milosevic government very bad, but that NATO will decide what to do about it. That's not the system we agreed upon. The system we agreed upon was that the Security Council would first evaluate the threat. Not NATO, not Germany, not the United States. The Security Council for the world would evaluate the threat, and once it has made the evaluation, would decide what action to take. NATO instead acts as judge, jury, and executioner, all in its own cause. And let me, again, if you'll permit me, delve a little bit further into the written word here. The United Nations Charter, in Article 53.1, states clearly that no enforcement action shall be taken under regional arrangements, read NATO, or regional agencies, without the authorization of the Security Council. Clearly, this action is illegal under the UN Charter. But further, Canada and the other NATO nations have retreated to the NATO Treaty. There's no comfort for them there. This action is illegal under the NATO Treaty itself. The NATO Treaty provides that the parties to the NATO Treaty are set forth in the Charter of the UN. The parties undertake to settle any international dispute in which they may be involved by peaceful means, in such a manner that international peace and security and justice are not endangered, and to refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force in any manner inconsistent with the purposes of the UN. The NATO Treaty goes on to recognize the primacy of the UN Security Council for the maintenance of international peace and security. So what have we done? We've looked and said, all right, we, Canada, the government of Canada, we are a signatory to a solemn treaty where we promise we will never go to war, save in self-defense, without the unanimous agreement of all the members of the Security Council. However, if we really, really, really want to go to war, we'll do it anyway. That's the effect of it. The difficulty with this position, without the framework of an international law built by the United Nations, we have no framework. We have anarchy. We go back to gunboat diplomacy, cruise missile diplomacy, call it what you will. Prior to World War I, the big, rich, important, and undoubtedly democratic nations of the West intervened willy-nilly around the world in the colonial countries, saying they were doing it for humanitarian reasons, civilizing missions, the white man's burden, and so forth. No one was there to evaluate them and to say whether they could or could not do it. They just did it. The same with World War II. That's how we got into that mess. At the end of World War II, we determined we weren't going to do that again. Now, at the end of the millennium, we're reverting to anarchy, international anarchy, the law of the lynch mob, the law of the vigilante. We're in the middle of an unfolding tragedy. The NATO bombs that are dropping on Yugoslavia are exploding international law, are exploding the peace and quiet which we should be able to expect for our children in future. We don't know where it leads. It leads nowhere good. It leads nowhere safe. It is dangerous. It is unlawful. It must stop.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jacobs. Before going to the next speaker, I want to take a minute to say a word about our ad hoc committee. There were a number of us that were stunned by the lack of opposition in our parliament to this war. And so we formed this ad hoc committee to speak out and give a voice to all of those people across this country who want to say no to this war and want it to stop. We began immediately after the bombardment began and have had a number of press conferences on the war, and now we're beginning a series of public meetings across Canada. These meetings are costly, and we rely solely on donations to mount our campaign, and so we will pass the bucket. We'll begin it going through here, and I ask if you will give generously to enable our battle to carry on. We will... We will gratefully accept checks and also credit card contributions at the table at the back. We have a whole series of literature on the tables at the back and books as well as other materials, that, wealth of materials that can be picked up. Oh, and it's been pointed out to me that I forgot to introduce myself here tonight. My name is David Orchard. So please pass the buckets quietly, and we'll carry on from the podium as they're being circulated. We're also circulating, you'll notice, a sign-up sheet that's going here, and this will enable us to let you know of future developments in our efforts to stop the war if you leave us your name and telephone number and address. Your name will not be sold or used in any other for anything other than the task at hand. So our next speaker is Michelle Chosadovsky. Michelle is...